Welcome, and thanks for listening to Intrinsic Investigations. My name is Mr. Olivo, and I created this podcast because I've been fortunate enough over the last decade to see unique and thought-provoking projects happen in my classroom, and we wanted a place to showcase them. The true heart of this podcast lies not in the content discovered, but in exploring the personal stories of these young researchers as they journey through uncharted and unfamiliar intellectual terrain. By sharing their stories, we hope to normalize the challenges and frustrations that come with independent research, and also share those moments where students transcend the normal grind of the school day to discover concepts that range from the global to deeply personal. We will begin with a brief introduction to the student of focus, why they picked their topic, and discuss their growth over the course of the last year. It should be mentioned that the opinions expressed in this podcast in no way reflect the opinions of our school district, Bergen County Technical Schools and Special Services, or our school itself, Bergen County Technical High School Teterboro, or the College Board. The work detailed in this podcast was most likely completed in AP Capstone, but this podcast is in no way affiliated with the College Board. Our guest for this episode is June, who will be discussing the phenomenon of media imperialism. I am joined by a student who engaged in a very interesting project involving a term I never heard before, media imperialism, but I'll let her introduce herself and the topic. Take it away.
Hi, my name is June Mient, and I researched media imperialism, which was a term coined by journalist Oliver Boyd Barrett, describing the dominance of Eurocentric or Western stories in the media at the expense of non-Western, lower socioeconomic countries. And I sort of studied that by comparing coverage for the war in Ukraine versus the military coup in Myanmar.
And why did you pick this topic?
I think it's very important to mention that my ethnic background is Burmese and my parents were both born in Myanmar. So, of course, it's important for me to sort of connect with my heritage and be able to explore something that I am intrinsically passionate about. That being said, aside from my personal background, I'm just overall interested in journalism and seeing how stories are covered and represented. I think everyone can assume that, of course, the crisis in Ukraine is much more heavily covered than the military coup in Myanmar. I'm sure some people maybe have never heard of the country Myanmar, but my intention here was to see whether there's a difference qualitatively, which I think has not been explored before.
Great, yeah, and the term that you introduced me to that I think is going to be key to understanding the differences in representation in terms of journalism is this idea of media imperialism. So do you want to speak to that for a moment before we get into the nitty-gritty details of what you did?
Just describing it?
Yeah.
Sure. So as I said before, it was a term coined by journalist Boyd Barrett. And essentially, it's just when countries that are European or have high socioeconomic status or just appeal to the Western narrative overall, they're just more amplified in the media. And it's this phenomenon where when they're amplified, it comes at the expense of non-Western or lower socioeconomic countries, such as Myanmar, that perhaps are not considered important in the scope of journalism, or maybe just don't fit the narrative of Western audiences.
And is this news media, or is this all media in general?
Certainly, it's all news media. It's broadcast journalism, it's written journalism, it's in local outlets, it's in international outlets, but I specifically looked at media imperialism across international news outlets just in written headlines, but certainly you could see this exemplified in broadcast journalism.
Does it exist in entertainment, this concept, or not that you're aware of? It's more...
Not that I'm aware of, but to my knowledge, I've never seen a Burmese character ever in any entertainment, unless it's like a Burmese film, which that's a given, of course.
Right, right. Okay. And how did you set about going to examine this issue? What method did you engage in? How did you try to put it into action? What did this look like?
So I did a mixed method study. First, I looked at the qualitative factors to this. So I essentially used a online scraper called Octoparse. And a scraper is when you collect any amount of data that you want from a certain website or whatever it may be. And I used Octoparse to collect 100 headlines about each crisis from each news outlet I looked at. So I looked at Al Jazeera, BBC, and the New York Times. And with two crises, that comes out to 600 headlines in total. And after I gathered those headlines and I got rid of duplicates or whatever, I coded them based off of codes that I got from a previous study. It's not coming to my brain right now by who it was, but essentially that was like my stimulus source, where I got all my codes from. So I coded them based on if they attributed to responsibility or omitted responsibility, whether they had crisis terminology or not, which is essentially when you use a noun to define the severity of a topic. And I also looked at whether they described civilian harm or not to show if whether these headlines humanize the situation, among other codes. And so that was my qualitative sort of approach. And I also looked at the quantitative aspect of it, essentially how many headlines were written about each crisis from this time point to this time point, just to see the overall difference in how much each topic was covered across the outlets. And then lastly, I looked at the time framing through which each conflict was reported. So I just wanted to see how relevant or how timely they were written. So essentially what I did is, with the headlines that I scraped to be qualitatively coded, I organized them based on the date they were published. And so I organized them based on whether they were published immediately after the crisis, 6 months to 1 year after, a year and a half to 2 years, and 2 years to 2 years and a half after.
And as you mentioned before, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think it's going to be shocking for anyone listening to imagine that the war in Ukraine is getting much more coverage in the outlets that you mentioned, Al Jazeera, BBC, than the coup in Myanmar.
No, not at all. Like, I mean, I agree with you.
Oh, okay.
I agree with you, of course.
But to, you know, in a previous episode, we talked with Kevin about his work involving firearms. And I guess what he found wasn't necessarily the firearm portrayal. That wasn't the most, the most salient thing he found through his work. It was the way that podcasts are used more as a marketing tool, even explicitly or implicitly. So if it may have been a given at the beginning that the Ukraine was going to have more coverage than Myanmar, what do you think is the most important takeaway beyond that supposition?
Of course, everyone can assume that the war in Ukraine is going to be more densely reported on, but I think the new or expository finding that I've discovered was that how they're qualitatively portrayed. Because while I believe that a news outlet does have the decision whether to cover more of one topic than another, for example, BBC is based in Europe, so of course they have a bias and a catering to the war in Ukraine, I don't think that that condones a difference in how they report each crisis. So I found that the military and coup in Myanmar, headlines about that issue did not attribute to responsibility often, which means they did not explicitly label the military as the antagonizer of the situation, whereas headlines often made sure to explicitly state that Russia is launching these strikes and Russia has this occupation. In addition to this, a lot of the headlines did not mention civilian harm. They were mainly based on economics or politics. They did not describe the human atrocities going on. And a lot of them did not label the coup with the severity that it deserves. They did not call it a war. They didn't call it a crisis. They didn't call it a violent situation. It just simply was a situation. And to me, that demonstrates certainly media imperialistic reporting, as well as bias from each of the news outlets. And this was consistent throughout all of them. Not a single one demonstrated any sort of equity between the two crises that I analyzed.
And what do you see as the equity between these two crises? Because you drew a lot of parallels between the two of them when selecting these two. It wasn't just because your background happens to be Burmese and related to this crisis. So what were those equities that you had drawn before beginning the investigation?
Right. I wanted to make sure that my selection wasn't arbitrary, so I made sure to explicitly state the similarities between each conflict. And so right off the bat, both are relatively recent and occurred pretty near to each other. The military coup in Myanmar happened in February of 2021, and then a year later, February 2022, is when the war in Ukraine started. Of course, there was like pre-existing tension, but that was like the official date. In addition, I think that a lot of people fail to be knowledgeable about Russia's presence in helping antagonize the people of Myanmar. A lot of aid has been sent to the military dictator General Mao Lin by Russian President Vladimir Putin, including a large sum of artillery, money, and also the troops, Russian troops and Burmese troops. They have joint naval exercises, and Myanmar and Russia, as of right now, are on good terms with each other, and they have had many friendly meetings. And so while, of course, Russia's antagonistic presence in Ukraine is much more explicit, it's important to acknowledge that it also has a role in pressing the conflict in Myanmar, which puts the two countries at similar targets of the same aggressor.
That inclusion criteria makes total sense.
Yes. And then, of course, the given is that they're both horrible humanitarian atrocities and just civilian harm on an absolutely upsetting scale.
In both cases. So what do you feel like is the most important thing that if someone were to read your paper? And I got into this a little bit in my conversation in a previous episode with Sawan and Mel, but numbers obviously can tell a story, but then when you get into the qualitative data and you look even deeper at the things that can't be measured numerically, there's another story to be told, which might alter human behavior just as much as stats. I mean, if you want to convince someone to do something, I'm sure the research would show that an effective story is just as good as being like, well, 90% of people do that. I'm sure stats are probably quite bad at persuading people. But what do you think the most important thing is to take away from this work? And what do you do with it, like with knowledge of this?
I think it's important just to highlight the humanitarian cost of both conflicts. And I think what's important for me, or what I really drew from my study, is that there are individual conflicts happening in the huge crisis occurring in Myanmar that are essentially disappearing or are not reported on at all. And the issue with that is that when you don't bring visibility or light to those situations, or you don't honor them or keep them in remembrance, they disappear from history. If you don't talk about something, it's going to go away. And so I noticed a lot of articles, specifically by the New York Times, described anniversary dates or remembrance articles about atrocities that occurred in Ukraine. Whereas when towns in Myanmar were massacred, for example, the town of Baziji, where many, many children, women and children and men were invited to a town meeting, and it was for Buddhist New Year, and they were offered free desserts and offered free food. And these people are poor beyond measure. They're poor and they're hungry. And so if you offer them free food, of course they're going to be so excited, especially the school children. And they were invited to the town meeting, and they were killed, about 300 of them killed by airstrikes launched by the military. And after they were killed, the military came back with guns and massacred the rest of the town. And many of these people were children who just wanted to enjoy dessert. But I didn't find any content about that in remembrance from any of the headlines, any of the news outlets. And to me, that speaks levels of how if we don't report history as transparently and authentically as possible with diligence, we are failing our duties as global citizens to remember these people and what they struggled through.
Well stated. And I thank you for your work, because there's so much, even right there, like these moments are just not reported. They're not part of the consciousness of the United States because, to your point, they're not reported on. So we see our international conflicts through how our international journalism operates. And if we don't recognize that that journalism has blind spots, there's very, you know, it just cuts off a complete part of our perspective that should be open. What do you, as you were doing this, where did you feel most, were there any moments where you felt misunderstood while delivering this information? How did you get over those miscommunications? Because you're talking about a lot. You're talking about geopolitics. You're talking about journalism. Were there moments where you were trying to explain it to people and they just were like, oh, okay, so what you're saying is this? And you're like, no, that's not what I'm trying to say at all.
Right. I think because there's such a disparity between how much and how each crisis was covered, and while I was talking about how badly Myanmar was covered and all the injustices served to them, I feel like some people I spoke to thought that maybe I'm like anti-war in Ukraine reporting, or I want there to be less coverage on that crisis, and that is by no means what I'm trying to deliver. I think that both conflicts are severe. They obviously can't be directly paralleled because they have their individual identities, but coverage between them deserves to be equitable, both quantitatively and qualitatively, especially within international news outlets, which I specifically selected news outlets that have published code of conducts publicly available that say that they want their, or they obligate their reporting and their journalists to talk about a variety of crises with equitable framing. That's why I chose those outlets. And so I think that they have 100% an obligation to have as equal and as equally framed coverage as possible. So I don't want people to think that somehow I don't want visibility for Ukraine to exist and I want Myanmar to dominate the front pages of news outlets. That's not at all what I'm trying to say. I think that the existence of coverage does not justify the omission of other coverage.
You speak so knowledgeably about this topic. Have you, before this class, before this year, done information gathering on this topic before? Were you very into it? Because it seems like you bring a lot to the conversation that we're having even now that couldn't just be attributed to the last 8 months.
I don't think I've ever done anything as academic and scholarly as what I've done in this class. But certainly Myanmar has been on my mind since 2021. And I have been involved in helping nonprofits and organizations raise money for this situation. There is this one organization, it's New York based, it's called NHFMM, the National Humanitarian Fundraiser for Myanmar. And they host a variety of events, charities towards Myanmar, helping the people, some people transition and move from Myanmar to America or help people better their living situation. And volunteering through those events, I was able to listen to keynote speakers describe their experience. And I think the knowledge that I obtained from that sort of helps me with my eloquence today. It helps me have a more nuanced perspective of this. I think if I wasn't as involved before the 8 months in this class, I wouldn't be as passionate speaking about this as I am today. And in addition to that, my family owns a restaurant.
I've been there.
Shameless plug. No, I promise this is important, but
you can shamelessly plug it. The Sato chips are fantastic. They're spicy, but they're delightful.
Yeah. Just growing up in that community, the only Burmese restaurant in New Jersey, being ethnically isolated like that, it kind of developed me to be this person that wants to help people whose stories aren't told be told and amplify the narratives of individuals who are either silenced by the media or just never have found a voice to begin with.
Do you want to say the name of the restaurant?
Amiar Kitchen.
Okay. My son had the chicken and potato curry, and that was the first curry he ever had. He loved it.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I think that was, he's 10 now, so that I think it happened when he was 8. But yes, get the chips. They're delightful. For the last question, you came into this, obviously, with a large amount of background knowledge, and which you just articulated really well. Is there anyone in the class or multiple people in the class who you think helped take your work into new and different and productive directions, even though they may not have known as much about the content as you?
Sure. I think multiple people have helped cultivated who I am today from beginning of the class to end of the class. Of course, I have to give a shout out to my girl, Elise. She's honestly like my pillar in the class. And not only is she just the friendliest and nicest person ever, her work academically, her work ethic is just so plausible. I don't even know if that's a word, but I'm making it a
word. We're going to roll with it like it is.
Yes. Every single critique she has to give, if you check any of her peer feedback, every single thing is so catered and so specific towards making you better. Like, she genuinely cares. Also, Daniel, everyone knows that he...
Everybody knows about
him. Everyone knows, yeah. Daniel is an awesome peer editor. He provided me with some sources to help kind of diversify my literature review and help make it a little more nuanced. He's studying something similar that I am, so that helped a lot.
He's a future episode.
Yep. And then I think also anyone who's in CompSign here, like watching them build their own scrapers like Reese, or like have the knowledge that they have of that sort of data, it just helped me understand like, okay, my original plan was to just look at the headlines and write them down. But I was like, okay, maybe I can get a little techie with this. Maybe I can go out of my comfort zone and try to find a scraper or even build a scraper. So that sort of upholstered me to contact Mr. Jamichi, who is the CompSci teacher, and figure out how I can most efficiently collect headlines. And because of that, I found the scraper Octoparse that I mentioned before. And that helped me expand my sample size about threefold, which I think ultimately just gives a more solid and reputable study in general.
Great. Yeah, great. Any words of advice for anyone who wants to take research or seminar or engage in independent research in the future? And we'll end with that.
I think at the school, there is a misconstrued notion that seminar and research are all humanities, and all the humanities kids take this class. And if you're a STEM kid, you should take physics, like, boo, seminar. I actually heard someone, a physics kid, say that seminar and research aren't real classes.
Wow.
And to that, I have to say, as much as I respect physics, to learn about velocity and acceleration, that is something catered to if you are going to pursue a physics career, which in itself is great. But if you take seminar and research, you are learning fundamental skills. You are learning public speaking, organization, working with others, writing, communication, everything and above and beyond. And all of that is applicable to any career you might pursue, whether it's in STEM or humanities. And so I think that if people had the capacity to take physics and research, they should. Because in this class, you have the freedom to develop a report or a study on anything you want. Like, I did it on media imperialism, but I know some of my classmates did super sciencey stuff like AI and muscular disease. Sorry, I don't know how to say it, but...
All right. June is referring to Adi's episode on Duchenne's muscular dystrophy and exon skipping, a meta-analysis. Stay tuned for that episode.
There is just such a diverse amount of topics that you can analyze in this class, and it gives you so much range and so much freedom. And I guess just to cap that off, my advice for anyone taking this class is to not box yourself or limit yourself to a specific identity or subject, and realize that this class is really for you to explore anything you could possibly want and make that an academic reality.
P equals MV for all you physics fans out there.
If you whatever
love,
that means.
If you love momentum. And again, it's not a competition. Ugh, that'd be like saying physics is not a... It's a real class.
Oh, physics, no. I love my STEM girlies. You're doing great, but no shame on research. I don't want to hear that.
I don't want to hear that either. Just why can't it just be peace and love and research all the time and physics all together? All right, June, thank you for a great interview. Enjoy the rest of your day and stay tuned for more episodes in the future.
Thank you.